This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
Let's turn our attention back a little bit to the Great Depression. The new book is The Forgotten Man, A New History of the Great Depression by Amity Schles, and she joins me on the long line. Amity is a senior fellow in economic history at the Council on Foreign Relations and a syndicated columnist at Bloomberg. She's written for the Financial Times, the Wall Street Journal, where she was an editorial board member. And we want to point out that The Forgotten Man has hit the bestseller list. Congratulations, Amity.
Thank you.
That's very great news. That's really wonderful. Tell me first, the best place to begin is, what were you working on and what's going on in your career when you know you're going to do a book about the Great Depression?
Well, I worked at the Wall Street Journal for a long time, and all of us who work in the world of markets, we bump into these institutions, SEC, Wagner Act, NLRB, short selling, we have a kind of a short memory. Where did this all come from? Why does the SEC exist? Why does a little bell go off when someone buys 5% of someone else's stock? And most of those institutions come out of the Great Depression period. The SEC, certainly. The idea that we're going to regulate this all nationally, the Wagner Act was the labor law. So I thought, well, were they good or were they bad? And there wasn't a lot of info on that. There are a few famous books, but so I went back and looked myself.
So the subtitle for your book is A New History of the Great Depression, and you really attack some sacred cows here. Give us an idea of, you know, the typical story we hear is that this was a great failure of American capitalism, and FDR and the federal government stepped in to save capitalism and save the country. What's right and what's wrong about this story we learned in school?
Right, that you described the story. Well, one, what we learned is the 20s were bad, like Great Gatsby, frivolous, you know, Looking Like Mia Farrow, people, all the money was speculative. The 20s were a great decade, so that's the first thing. Because just as the 90s are now being trashed and discussed, or the first half of this decade, the 20s were trashed then because of the severity of the crash. I think the 20s had a lot of good in them, and I found the data for that as well in terms of productivity gains, promise of productivity gains, and so on. Second myth is Hoover was Mr. Laissez-faire, and so he made it worse by not doing anything. Hoover made it worse indeed, but rather by doing too much. So how did he do too much? Signed a bad tariff, Smoot-Hawley, raised taxes. We kind of know we're not supposed to do that in a downturn. Berated the stock market, blamed the messenger, stopped short selling, tried to restrict it. We have the same impulse now at the SEC. That was one myth that came down for me. Hoover was a kind of like a consultant, smartest guy in the room, loved to fiddle. Very self-oriented, as a narcissistic, and he did some damage, and FDR did a whole lot more.
We're talking with Amity Schles. The new book is The Forgotten Man, A New History of the Great Depression. Amity, who is the man in the title? Who is the forgotten man?
It's a wonderful story. Of course, we may have heard FDR's speech in 1932 when unemployment was 2 in 10. He spoke of the forgotten man at the bottom of the economic pyramid. So you think of the homeless person, and we all have a lot in our heart for that person. But he took the concept of the forgotten man from somewhere, unknowingly, but from somewhere, from a famous essay by a philosopher called The Forgotten Man. That philosopher was William Graham Sumner, and Sumner had a different forgotten man. He said it through algebra. So have a little patience and hear the algebraic equation. He said A wants to help X. Well, we all want to do that. We want to help X. The guy down there, right? And B wants to help X. Also good. We want to do charity. We want all of our brethren to be okay. Comes the problem when A and B get together and pass a law that coerces C into funding their perhaps good, but perhaps dubious, project for X. C is the forgotten man, the man who pays, the man who endures, the man who prays in his line, and the man who is not thought of. The taxpayer who funds the progressive project. And people in the period knew both these forgotten men. they were quite familiar with William Graham Sumner, even if FDR forgot. So they knew that the forgotten man of FDR and the forgotten man of Sumner were in opposition, the man who gets the money from the government and the man who pays for that, giving the money to the government, and that tension between them. And they debated it the whole year, and it struck me as relevant to today when we have so many tax and entitlement obligations. This tension is again present.
Emily Schlaes is a senior fellow in economic history at the Council on Foreign Relations. Her book, now in paperback, best-selling, The Forgotten Man, A New History of the Great Depression. Emily, give us an idea, and feel free to talk at length here and talk specifics. How exactly did the government make the Great Depression worse? Or not necessarily even worse, but make it go on longer than it should have?
Well, by getting the monetary wrong, and that's what the classic books say. They say, well, it turns out FDR and Roosevelt alike saw inflation. They feared inflation when there was really deflation. And that's what Milton Friedman taught us long ago, and Alan Meltzer's more recent book. They tightened when we were too tight already. So that's one. But what the Forgotten Man looks at is the other non-monetary components, because monetary alone cannot explain 1935 to 1940. And, you know, we had a credit crunch, a financial crisis very similar to what we just had. Worse, though, more banks failed than we even have in the Great Depression. But it didn't go all the way to 1940. So what made the Depression great in duration? What I found was the perversity of New Deal law. For example, we know that when businesses are struggling, they have to cut costs, including that of labor. And yet, under the New Deal, they had to raise pay or keep it high, especially after the passage of the big labor law, the Wagner Act, in 1935. And so they were losing profits to pay that high wage, and productivity was not going up commensurate to the wage increases, so that corporations were losing money a lot for many years, and they kind of went on strike. They said, I don't like this. They also didn't hire. So the truism, it was all right if you had a job, is true, or the truism, nice work if you can get it, but a lot of people couldn't get it. And that's why you see these horrendous figures. 2 in 10 were unemployed, winter of 37-38. Imagine if now, 8 or 9 years hence, we had 2 in 10 unemployed, 20% unemployment. That would be a crash, and that's what they endured. And that labor factor, economists such as Lee Ohanian, I'm throwing out all these names because I like to base this on reality when I talk about it. Lee Ohanian at UCLA is doing work on this. Edward Prescott, who's a Nobel Prize winner at the Minneapolis Fed, has done work on this. We see now that those labor increases, what FDR did for the worker, were not benign. They made it so hard on business, business didn't grow. And I actually did a great Google graph of the frequency of the phrase capital strike in, you know, for a presentation on the Forgotten Man book. And I can see that they used that phrase quite a lot in the second half of the 30s in the newspapers. Capital did go on strike. The New Yorker cartoons are true. People cried into their martini in their country house, and they said, I'm going to wait this out and not create any jobs.
We're talking with Emily Schlaes. The book is The Forgotten Man, A New History of the Great Depression. It reminds me of, is it Atlas Shrugged, where they just sort of walk off, where all the folks just walk off, you know, Ayn Rand and Objectivism, and this idea that those industry kings and the folks behind the folks who come up with the ideas that run industry are just going to shrug their shoulders and walk away and do their own thing.
Well, that part, I'm not actually someone who's ever read Ayn Rand, because I find it kind of hard to read. But
fair enough.
There was shrugging of shoulders and walking away. In the book, I get to a character who's interesting to us all now, to Alfred Lee Loomis. Loomis was a very innovative guy. He'd done some work on innovations in the munitions arms field in World War I. He was quite interested in utilities governance in the 20s, and this was the big problem. How do we get the capital in a deflationary period, and the 20s were also deflationary, to fund this enormous capital-intensive exercise, the electrification of America? And so he was like, you know, structuring companies, thinking about federal law, thinking about the absence of federal law, doing cool things. And when he saw the New Deal coming, he said, that's not for me. There's too much testimony, too much court. I don't like to go to Washington to be grilled by lawmakers. It's not to my taste. So I will retreat to my country house. His country house was in Tuxedo Park, and he had his own little private think tank where he kind of fooled around and did interesting stuff, invited famous scientists. He withheld his talent from the marketplace, and a lot of people did that. A lot of people. And then he came back when the war happened because of patriotism, and he did interesting stuff, radar-related, in World War II. So a lot of people said, I'm not... This party's without me, not me. Yeah. You know, count me out. In the 30s, and paradoxically, we always say there was too much labor in the 1930s. That unemployment, there was too little skill, because skill often withheld itself. I'm going to London, not count me out again. And I thought that was fascinating, so different from what we learned.
Amity Schles is a senior fellow in economic history at the Council on Foreign Relations. The book is The Forgotten Man, and we're going to be giving away a free copy here at the end of the interview. Eric has been waiting patiently online too. Eric, thanks for the call. You're on with Amity Schles. You go right ahead.
Coy, I am so glad you have her on right now. It couldn't be more timely. We are making the same ridiculous mistakes now that they made then in terms of bailing out the worst banks that made the stupid mistakes, rewarding all the worst sort of corporate behavior, and making things worse rather than better. So what I'd like to ask Amity is, could you care to talk a little bit about what they did with taxes back then and how that could have possibly extended the Great Depression, made things worse, if you haven't already mentioned it?
Well, thank you for that wonderful intro. One, two. Think of the parallels. They had a Reagan revolution in the 20s. Their taxes were high, and then Andrew Mellon, the amazing Treasury Secretary, brought them down. In fact, taxes were cut 5 times in the 1920s. They went from over 50%, I believe, 70s, down to a top marginal rate, and I'll say it slowly, of 25%. So they were very proud of that. Improved at certain points treatments of capital gains, also important for business, went after estate taxes, and Mellon did most of this. What Hoover and FDR did was undo the Republican Revolution. So history repeats itself, right? And Hoover, a Republican himself, undid it some. In 1932, the crisis, budget balancing, sort of similar to now, they were 2 or 3 years into the crisis, we need to balance the budget. He raised the rate, ended that 25 or even 24% rate by then, and pushed it way up. And then FDR came in, and something changed, and he did something worse. He also raised the rate even higher. You see rates going up to 90. But also he said, you know what? The tax code is for class warfare. The rich are to blame for this, and we're going to use the tax code to get the rich. And that really hadn't happened before in America. As you know, or the listener probably knows, regular people didn't pay taxes then. It was a class tax, not a mass tax yet, as they say. And so the only people who paid taxes were the rich, so you could really raise them and not hurt anyone. It's sort of similar to now, where we have higher earners carrying an unusual share of the burden. And they raised them to get those bad people. There was a moral component. And that, again, was made you not want to work. And everyone, there's this sort of static idea on the part of people that the business cycle is weather. There's nothing you can do about it. It comes and goes. You can get the rich guy and it won't affect his behavior. But the rich guy, or any business, is very, very susceptible to incentives and disincentives. And when those confiscatory taxes came, they also had an undistributed profits tax, it's like a wealth tax. So if you decided not to invest in something because you felt it wasn't a good year to buy a new piece of machinery, or you didn't give out dividends, then they had a tax on that. They really, a third component of tax, which isn't about rates but is related, is they went into enforcement mode because, again, of the deficit, and they went after everyone. Everyone was audited. Mellon, the old Treasury Secretary there, Greenspan was audited. They decided they didn't care about the difference between avoidance and evasion, evasion being the illegal one. They put everyone, even people who took deductions to which they were entitled under the law, clearly such as Mellon, in the bad tax shirk category. And it made the U.S., you know, The Economist magazine took a a look at the U.S., and the Economist magazine is always snarky because they're U.K., and they said, gee whiz, by the end of the 30s, looks like America forgot how to grow.
We're talking with Amity Slays. The new book is now in paperback is The Forgotten Man, A New History of the Great Depression. Eric, you still with us?
I am. I think the fact that Amity is talking about the enforcement mechanism and how totalitarian it actually was. I mean, we're talking about businessmen being arrested for charging too little for things, or the total control they took of the economy, from prices being set for absolutely everything. I mean, unprecedented sort of growth of government into areas where Americans never before would have allowed them, much like, I don't think in our worst nightmares we would have imagined that the nine biggest banks would have their major leaders brought into a small room with Hank Paulson, who then orders them to sell shares at a non-negotiable price. I mean, this is just insanity repeating itself.
Yeah, the assault on equity, too, is interesting. Why is equity first?
Yeah, it's mind-boggling. And
what
I really
is equity? Equity is actually super important, right? Because it's ownership. And sometimes you have a bond bias, and this is one of those periods, don't you think?
Yeah, absolutely. And I really appreciate this book because it's causing people, and it's part of a larger reassessment of FDR in general, who, I think has been given much more credit than he has deserved criticism. So,
Eric, do you have the book yet?
I don't. I would love a copy.
It's yours.
Hold on just a minute.
Great.
Thank you.
Hold on just a minute. Glenn, Eric is online too. And Eric, thanks so much for participating in the conversation this afternoon. Eric's got a copy of The Forgotten Man. And Amity Slays is the best-selling author. She is a senior fellow in economic history at the Council on Foreign Relations. And again, the book is The Forgotten Man, A New History of the Great Depression. Amity, great to talk to you. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, look, thank you. It was a pleasure.
You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit SeavillePodcast.com for more.